Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 31st of March, the last day of the first quarter, believe it or not. And we are thrilled to have you with us on this day. 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. It is a Wednesday, and we are happy to have you. Let me introduce everybody, and we'll get started. Also, we welcome you to join us. And if you have a thought, a question for the group, anything you'd like to share with us, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm all right, except I want to say something. Enough already.
What?
This thing about snow tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This thing about snow tomorrow, this is not good. It's enough already, so maybe we could just move on.
It does seem like it's time to move on, but we're here in the great Northeast, and we all can tell stories of snow in May, but it's still, it's for April, and, you know, April Fool's Day and a snowstorm, you know, you put those two together, so maybe it's just that.
You're so right, as always.
Bob Griffin is with us. He is Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everybody. I just need to prepare everybody.
All right, Bob, you're having some problems with the our Opal technology.
Good morning.
All right, are you okay? Are you better now? Bob, can you hear me? All right, so we're going to have Bob disconnect and reconnect, and we'll work on that. And then I think when he comes back, he won't sound like a robot. So that will be very good. In rehearsal, he did not sound like a robot, but now he does. So we'll work on that.
We all have some robot in us.
Exactly. A little robotic tendencies, certainly. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill is with us, ever the human. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. Was there a rehearsal? Because I don't think I was invited.
Well, there was a run through on the board to make sure everybody was there and we could hear them. And, you know, that was as close as we get, sure.
Oh, I was going to say.
But, yeah. Well, good to have you back. We missed you. It's nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
And Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist, UAlbany adjunct professor. Rosemary, I saved you till last because I wanted to ask you. I know you have written about this on your social media, so I assume it's not a secret. But you were away. You were out of country.
Yeah.
Doing good work, so I was hoping you could just share for a moment what was going on there in Macedonia, correct?
Sure. Yes, North Macedonia. Regular Macedonia is in Greece. That's not where I was. I was in the Balkans, in Skopje. And I've taught there before, young journalists interested in investigative reporting. And we decided to do it, to try it in person this year because I'm fully vaccinated and because North Macedonia at the time we were planning this a month ago had the lowest rate of the disease in all of Europe. That has changed. They're seeing a surge not unlike what we're seeing here in the States. And so I ended up going over there, and most of the participants, the majority of participants, were afraid, rightly so, of coming into a classroom where they'd be with others, even though we were socially distant. So I ended up traveling all that way and all that time to teach in a hybrid class. I was on Zoom. I could have done that here in Albany, but it was fabulous to be traveling again. All the inconveniences from lost baggage to rude TSA agents seemed dear to my heart this time.
Well, it's good to have you back. Thank you very much, and thank you for sharing with us. Bob Griffin, I think you've been reconnected. How you doing?
I hope so. Can you hear me, Joe?
Yeah, you sound great.
Perfect.
Oh,
you sound really
thank
good.
You. I don't think it's probably the best I'm going to sound all morning, so thank you so much.
Well, good to have you here. Thank you very much. All right, let's start, and we'll go over what's there's a ton of places we could start, but I'm going to go with the Matt Gaetz story, because this story is, I mean, there's a surface story, and then there's the backstory, and then there's the conjecture, and it is messed up, and it's really hard, and it's very confusing, and I don't know what to think of it, but here we go. So this is what we know at the moment, and obviously this is under an investigation and is part of a much larger investigation, and we will see. So this, the best synopsis of it I saw was in the New York Times, who broke the story, but Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican of Florida and a close ally of former President Donald Trump, is being investigated by the Justice Department over whether he had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old and paid for her to travel with him, according to three people briefed on the matter. Investigators are examining whether Mr. Gaetz violated federal sex trafficking laws, the people said. A variety of federal statutes make it illegal to induce someone under 18 to travel over state lines to engage in sex in exchange for money or of something of value. The Justice Department regularly prosecutes such cases, and offenders often receive severe sentences. So it's not clear how Mr. Gaetz met the girl, believed to be 17 at the time of encounters about 2 years ago, that investigators are scrutinizing, according to two of the people. The investigation was opened in the final months of the Trump administration under Attorney General William Barr. Given Mr. Gaetz's national profile, senior Justice Department officials from Washington, including some appointed by Mr. Trump, were notified of the investigation. The three people said that the examination of Mr. Gaetz, who is 38, is part of a broader investigation into a political ally of his, a local official in Florida named Joel Greenberg. And this is where it all starts getting, like, super sketchy, who was indicted last summer on an array of charges, including sex trafficking of a child and financially supporting people in exchange for sex, at least one of whom was underage. Mr. Greenberg, who has since resigned his post as tax collector in Seminole County north of Orlando, visited the White House with Mr. Gaetz in 2019, according to a photograph that Mr. Greenberg posted on Twitter. There are all kinds of photos with Mr. Green with this rogues gallery there's one with he, Mr. Greenberg, Matt Gaetz, and Roger Stone. They're all starting to come out now. No charges have been brought against Mr. Gaetz, and the extent of his criminal exposure is unclear. Mr. Gaetz said in an interview last night on, yes, Fox News, that his lawyers had been in touch with the Justice Department, and they were told he was the subject, not the target, of an investigation. I only know that it has to do with women, Mr. Gaetz said. I have a suspicion that someone is trying to recategorize my generosity to ex-girlfriends as something more untoward. We'll let it go there for the moment. Alan.
Thanks for calling on me, Joe. I always
I'm happy to go anywhere else. I just wanted to give you a first refusal.
I always appreciate that. Oh, well, the answer is that, you know, if in fact this turns out to be something he did, it's going to be very tough on him, no question. Number two, the major charge is hypocrisy. These are the guys who are pretending that they are on God's side, that they are always good, and in fact, it will hurt. Maybe it'll hurt. It didn't hurt Donald Trump, who, of course, is the greatest, espouser of his sexual relationships that we have seen. In fact, my wife has a T-shirt with all of his words on it. So I can only say that this is bad news for Gaetz and for his crowd. How did I do, Joe?
You know, it is. The story just gets weirder and weirder. So Mr. Gaetz called the investigation. He had a bunch of interviews yesterday. And he called the investigation part of an elaborate scheme involving false sex allegations to extort him and his family for $25 million that began this month. He said he and his father, Don, had been cooperating with the FBI and wearing a wire after they were approached by people saying they could make the investigation go away. Mr. Gaetz claimed the disclosure of the sex trafficking inquiry was intended to thwart an investigation into the extortion plot. In a second interview later Tuesday, the congressman said he had no plans to resign his House seat and denied that he had romantic relationships with minors. It is verifiably false that I have traveled with a 17-year-old woman, he said, which is different than I had a relationship with a 17-year-old woman. Rosemary, please enlighten us.
Okay, so my first view is, boy, am I enjoying even these accusations, if anyone deserves the pressure and humiliation of a federal investigation of their sex life. It is this gas bag who's just been an embarrassment in the Congress, and I hope he is withering in discomfort. Second, if we ever needed an illustration of the bad decisions teenagers make, going out with Matt Gaetz certainly fits that bill. And third, the whole ridiculous story that you've recounted here makes me think that QAnon's crazy theories are not exactly so crazy. This is another Jeffrey Epstein. What is it with politicians and young girls? Stop it.
Well, there's that, right? Now, certainly, I feel horrible for the young women involved in this case. Not that there are multiple cases with Matt Gaetz. However, in the entire sex trafficking ring that is involved in this investigation, including Mr. Greenberg, there are a few minors, and that, of course, is just dreadful. Bob Griffin.
Yeah, let me dive headfirst into the septic tank, Joe. You know, there are a couple points here that I think are important, and it's easy to make light of the situation. It's easy to poke fun at Matt Gaetz, but I mean, it's a really serious situation if you think about it. I mean, they're talking about interstate trafficking of minors for sexual exploitation. I thought it was interesting. I saw the clip from Fox last night, and Gaetz tried to bring Tucker Carlson into this almost as a defendant. And if anyone sees it, it's really interesting because Carlson pushed back and said that he had no recollection of what Gaetz was trying to say. This is a continued problem. And you put your finger on it, Rosemary, that, you know, when we talk about the swamp, using Trump's language, there is a problem. There is a problem in D.C. There is a problem with men in power and the people who we elect to represent us. And Matt Gaetz is I've always felt that he was unfit to hold office, and this just sort of proves it. But it's a serious crime, and this is a serious problem.
Tucker Carlson denies the Gaetz claim that he met the witness in FBI probes, and then went on to say it was one of the weirdest interviews I've ever conducted, meaning his interview last night with Matt Gaetz. So there is that.
Which is saying a lot. And the other point, Joe, that I really want to drive home, this investigation was started under the Barr administration over justice. Okay, so when this is being portrayed as the Biden administration is going after poor GOPers, that's not the case. This was started under Barr.
Meanwhile, and not for nothing, I just want to point out that there were stories circulating about Matt Gaetz about 48 hours ago before these charges came out, that he was getting ready to mysteriously and weirdly pack it up and quit the Congress so he could go work at Newsmax, and had publicly said that he felt he could be a stronger voice there. I thought that was extremely weird at the time, 2 days ago. And now you get some idea of where maybe that was headed, of what he knew and when he knew it. Chris Churchill.
Yeah, I mean, that didn't strike me as that odd that he would leave Congress, because he's always been a little bit more of a media personality than a serious congressman anyways. But I did watch that interview with Tucker Carlson, and it was bizarre. You could see that Carlson was uncomfortable with a lot of it, including when Matt Gaetz named the supposed former DOJ official who he said was extorting him. I mean, named him by name.
So that just screws up the entire investigation, right? I mean, that's not, you're not supposed to do that.
Well, you're not supposed to do what exactly? Name who's extorting you? I mean, if somebody was really extorting them, I can see why he might name the person. I mean, you know, there's obviously reasons to be suspicious of that story, but like you, as you said in the intro, it's an extremely convoluted and confusing story. I mean, I guess all we can be grateful for is that Florida politics are still as bizarre as they ever were. And, you know, I mean, it's just, you look at the cast of characters involved in this, including Roger Stone and some other people who, you know, have less than stellar reputations. And it's just, it's a little bit mind blowing. But that said, I Matt Gaetz does deserve the presumption of innocence. I mean, I don't think we should assume that the allegation is true just yet. I mean, there's a lot to this, apparently.
Josh, taking me into task, referring to these charges, and he's right. I should have said.
Yeah, there are no charges.
No charges, yeah. Should have said allegations. Yeah. And also takes one of our panelists to task of saying what makes him unfit to serve, according to one of your guests.
Joe, could I answer that?
If you can in 34 seconds, you sure can.
I think he was unfit even before the charges. I don't think that he has the intellectual capacity or the moral capacity to be a leader, period.
And this was brought out on Rachel Maddow's program yesterday, and Wesley brings it up in a letter to us. If you want to just have your head spin a little bit more, in 2017, when they took a vote on human trafficking of children, Matt Gaetz was the only Congress member to vote against human trafficking legislation.
Yeah.
Let that sink in for a moment. We'll take a break. We'll be back. We'll continue on this and talk about other aspects. Plus, we'll include your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin all on the show today. Very nice to have you with us, and we thank you. We have many letters on this Matt Gaetz story. We go initially to Kathy, who says, isn't it always the case if the GOP accuses the Dems of something, look closer, because that is exactly what they're doing? Pedophilia, Pizzagate. It's classic projection, that from Kathy. Then we go to Wesley. Gaetz was, as I mentioned, only congressman to vote against human trafficking legislation. Coincidence? Says Wesley. Then Matthew. Gaetz, now accused of sex trafficking, was the only, again, to vote against human trafficking. Inexplicably, Gaetz was one of the only votes against sanctions on Myanmar over the military coup, a bill that enjoyed broad bipartisan support. Myanmar, also known as Burma, was identified by the State Department as a Tier 3 country for sex trafficking, meaning it is one of the top sources of trafficked people worldwide. The rabbit hole keeps going deeper. Then there is Peter. Anyone who is surprised that a close confidant of Trump might be cavorting with underage women must have been in a coma for the last 4 years. The Trump White House and Mar-a-Lago certainly seem to be reminiscent of the imperial court of the Roman Emperor Caligula. Hey, Mike Huckabee, what do you have to say about this? Which biblical figure does Matt Gaetz represent? Asks Peter. Then we go to this letter from Sasha and says, it is so upsetting when predators refer to the underage girls as women. In Gaetz's statement, I did not travel with a 17-year-old woman. A teenager is a child. It is a minor. Let's be clear. If these allegations are true, Gaetz had a sexual relationship with a child. That from Sasha.
Yeah, Joe, and if I could jump in on that, I also have already started to see the defense that she was age of consent, which is, again, not true according to the federal law. So you can already start to see some of the circles trying to circle the wagons around Gaetz with all of these ridiculous defenses.
My favorite part is that he's being punished for being overly generous to an ex-girlfriend. Is that the 17-year-old? I really want to know more about that. Well, and that girl woman thing is that's the fault of Me Too. We don't know what to call 17, 18, 19 year old women anymore. Yes, they are teenagers, but are they girls or women? This is we've made that confusing, and because we don't want to be infanticized. But obviously this is, he's going to call her a woman because it makes him seem less disgusting, and we will call her a girl because it makes him seem more of a monster.
Well, Valerie says that either way, by him calling her a woman, it makes him a slime ball, is what Valeria says. So for whatever that's worth. Chris, were you going to say something?
No, I mean, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it. Just everyone seeming to assume that he's guilty. I mean, he has flatly denied the claims, you know, and I think that's important to keep mentioning. I'm always a little bit uncomfortable with stories that are, you know, about investigations and they're about leaks because, you know, it always raises the question of why did somebody leak this at the particular time? And I'm not saying that because I buy into Matt Gaetz's story at all about, you know, the extortion and how this was supposed to be, today was supposed to be a big day and the story ruined all that. But, you know, it is very hard for anybody. And even if people don't like Matt Gaetz, he does deserve the presumption of innocence. It's very hard for anybody to defend themselves against these kind of leaked allegations when there's no name on one. There's a name on one side and no name on the other. And I just think that's a very difficult situation.
I don't disagree.
Yeah, I bet that Liz Cheney shares that view of him when he was out there campaigning against her when she tried to stop the impeachment, or when he burst into the chamber and tried to stop a very legitimate impeachment of Trump. I don't think there's anything wrong with enjoying the discomfort of these allegations against this man, and I am horrified.
You can just enjoy him all you want. I'm not saying you shouldn't enjoy him, but I'm just saying he deserves the presumption. Enjoy all you want, but, you know, he also deserves the presumption of innocence.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I've been falsely accused of a terrible sex act, you know, and we'll see where it goes, but I'm not willing to assume that he's guilty just yet.
Chris, I agree with you. If you think about it, last week we were talking about the issue with Cuomo. And, you know, and we said the same thing, that, you know, it's allegations and let the investigation play itself out. I absolutely agree with you. With that said, even with the allegations, I think it's fair game to talk about the hypocrisy of public positions that men in power have made.
Yeah. And, I'm all for letting the investigation go forward with Cuomo, too. But the one difference I would point to is that there are actually people with names who have come forward to make the allegations, and the governor hasn't denied some of them. So it's a very different situation, obviously. But
well, it also has become very convoluted, even on the congressman's part, in trying to defend himself of he and his father wearing a wire. And I mean, it's just the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a bizarre
story, made more bizarre by the accused himself.
Yeah, and that, like I said, that interview on Tucker Carlson last night was bizarre, and you could see that. As you said, Tucker Carlson described it as one of the weirdest interviews he's ever conducted. So there's a lot of strange aspects to the story, and I'm sure we'll learn a lot more going forward.
Certainly. We'll see. Anyone else on this story? Otherwise, I will move on. Okay. We go to another story now, and this having to do – well, we only have a few minutes before we go to our break, so – let's talk for a moment about G. Gordon Liddy, who passed yesterday, an undercover operative convicted in the Watergate scandal, was 90 years old and passed away yesterday. The undercover operative, whose bungling of the Watergate break-in triggered one of the gravest constitutional crises in American history and led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon. He died at his daughter's home in Fairfax County, Virginia. His son, Thomas Liddy, confirmed the death but did not give a cause, saying only that it was unrelated to the coronavirus. A theatrical personality whose event-filled career included more twists and turns than a fictional potboiler, Mr. Liddy was at various times an FBI agent, jailbird, radio talk show host, best-selling author, candidate for Congress, an actor and promoter of gold investments. The role for which he is best remembered was in the plot to bug the Democratic Party headquarters in Watergate, in the Watergate complex in June of 1972. Alan.
I remember it as if it were yesterday, and I have to say, there's an old saying that only the good die young. This is not a good guy. But he was a profiteer from his bad acts. And as a result, he is, he's remembered by many people as being a bad guy and being central to the Watergate scandal.
Rosemary.
My students have no idea who he is, which makes me realize how quickly everything is lost. He also is remembered as a bad guy, but he was incredibly bad at what he did. He's the main reason that the Washington Post reporters connected a third-rate burglary with the White House, and they did it almost immediately. It was through his connections. He was completely unrepentant. He also was Rush Limbaugh, creation of right-wing radio. So he harmed the democracy not only in his direct assault at Watergate, but in his use of the media that brought us fake news and polarization. So rest in peace. I'm glad he's gone.
Mr. Liddy refused to cooperate with prosecutors in Congress and was sentenced in March 1973 to a 20-year prison term for conspiracy, burglary, and illegal wiretapping. President Jimmy Carter commuted Liddy's sentence in 1977, and he was released after only 52 months behind bars. Chris Churchill.
What did Carter do that? Does anybody remember?
I don't remember what the... Does anyone know? I don't remember what the... or know why that was done.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting that Carter did that. G. Gordon Liddy, I remember him only vaguely. I know more from movies than anything, but, I guess in one way it just goes to show that these kind of characters, these Roger Stone-type characters have been around for a lot longer than we sometimes think.
Bob Griffin.
Chris, you took the analogy. I always felt that G. Gordon Liddy was the person that Roger Stone wanted to be and couldn't for whatever reason. One issue that we haven't raised here, though, is the definition, the warped sense of what masculinity is in this country, and there's a lot to unpack here with G. Gordon Liddy. You start to think about how he's tried to wrap himself as a patriot and as the constitutionalist. You talked about how he was unrepentant in the face of the investigation. It all points to I think some of the underlying problems that we're seeing in today's society is he was put up on a pedestal. He was a criminal and he was a bad criminal. I mean, that's even worse. I mean, reading a lot of articles, they refer to him as bungling, which is not the way you want to go to your, not the way you want to go to your grave. but you think about it is that he was celebrated by a portion of the country for being a bad criminal. And being very proud about it. So I'm not celebrating his passing, but at the same time, I think we need to take a hard look at what he did and what we did as a society.
That reinvention as a conservative talk show host, I mean, he was successful at that for a very long time. It was after Rush Limbaugh, but certainly was on the air for a long time in many, many markets. I don't want to forget the fact that he had local connections as well. Leaving the FBI, he worked for several years in patent law with his father's firm, and in 1965 became an assistant district attorney in Poughkeepsie. He became a local conservative folk hero through his involvement in the 1966 arrest of Timothy Leary, a former Harvard professor conducting unorthodox drug research. Narrowly defeated in a GOP congressional primary, he took charge of the Nixon-Agnew campaign in Dutchess County in 1968 and was rewarded with a post as special assistant to the Secretary of the Treasury. So local connections there as well. We'll take a break. Go ahead, Bob.
No, I was just going to say, I listened to his radio show. He was very, very entertaining.
Yes, very much so.
Scary.
Well, that too. We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have much more to discuss. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning, the 31st of March. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin with us. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So let's talk about this, shall we? We mentioned it yesterday. Actually, today is Wednesday, so we mentioned this on Monday, and we were talking about the vaccine passports. Republicans are now seeking to make that idea the next battle in the pandemic culture wars. Republicans are opening a new front, attacking efforts by the Biden administration to develop guidelines for coronavirus vaccine passports that businesses can use to determine who can safely participate in activities such as flights, concerts, and indoor dining. We talked about this on Monday because it was unveiled in New York State, the Excelsior Passport, which is going to be used as soon as this week to enter Madison Square Garden as well as other venues. The issue has received an increasing amount of attention from some of the party's most extreme members and conservative media figures, but it has also been seized on by Republican leaders like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who is considered a potential 2024 presidential candidate. "We are not supporting doing any vaccine passports in the state of Florida," DeSantis said Monday. "It's completely unacceptable for either the government or the private sector to impose upon you the requirement that you show proof of vaccine to just simply be able to participate in normal society." And I would take... I think my problem with that phrase is the normal society when is normal a global pandemic, but more on that in a moment. Other Republicans have used more inflammatory rhetoric, including Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, calling the passport idea Biden's mark of the beast, and some conservative activists comparing it with Nazi policies to identify Jews. The hypercharged rhetoric is directed at a nascent initiative between the Biden administration and private companies to develop a standard way for Americans to show that they've received a coronavirus vaccination. The idea behind the passports or certificates is that they would be a way to ensure that people could return to normal activities without risking further spread of the virus that has killed more than 550,000 Americans over the past year plus. Alan.
I'm all for it. I think it's a great idea. I think it ought to be done. We have no idea where the end of this is. Anything that we can do that will mitigate what we are facing is good as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure that there will be some civil libertarians, some people who think that this is not a good idea, but I'm all for it.
I do find it interesting that the Republican complaints about this are the rhetoric that I mentioned, and not some of the larger concerns that I think really are legitimate, such as access to everyone, and if does everyone have a smartphone, and how fair is that, and if you don't, and it's certainly if people who have been vaccinated but do not have access to such technology, are they left out, and the fairness aspect to it, and certainly once again those on the lower rungs of the economic ladder would be shut out. Bob Griffin.
Oh boy, there's a lot to unpack here too, and you know, we started with Snow, and then we went to Matt Gaetz, and then we went to G. Gordon Liddy, and now we go to this. It's boy, it's really depressing today. So I apologize
Wacky Wednesday.
To everybody. Happy Wednesday. My question to DeSantis, first let me start with I think what you're seeing is this sort of mock outrage, particularly from people on the far right, who are on the back heels right now. You know, if you think about what's been happening at the ballot box and what the society has been pushing back on them on, I think this is their attempt to try to create that sort of outrage and victimhood that frankly Trump successfully used in his presidential election. My question is that I have several. One is if you don't like it, then what is your plan? And we've seen what DeSantis says is just open everything up and let everybody else deal with the problem. You know, you start to think about what he did in spring break, in all of, or in a huge percentage of the people involved in spring break have gone back to the other states, who are now going to have to deal with the problems from his lack of leadership. I struggle because my other question is, I want to know, you know, I do want to get back to Madison Square Garden. I want to go to concerts. I want to go sit in a bar, but you know, I want to do it safely. And if this is a mechanism that can help us, you know, slowly get back to some sense of where we were pre-COVID, because I never think we're going to be back to the same place exactly. I'm all for it. And if it's a step that we can make that will help restaurants and the entertainment industry get back and running, let's do it. The other point is, you know, when I go to the airport, I have to show an identification anyway. So if it's just one more form of identification, but my knowledge that everybody else on that plane is both safe and vaccinated, it's worth it to me.
Rosemary.
Well, I sort of get the complaint of the conservatives. I've lived in societies where you had to move around and always have your papers with you and could be demanded at any time to show them. And I always loved coming back to the United States, where you can even leave your driver's license at home and you won't get into trouble. You have to produce it later, but you don't totally get into trouble. So I do think that is the sign of a free society. However, a pandemic changes everything. When I traveled this week, it was incredibly confusing. I have a card, as many of you do who have been vaccinated, in New York State, that shows I got it. No one ever asked to see that. That has, you fly out of JFK, which is New York. I didn't even get asked there about it. There were rumors that you had to have a WHO, World Health Organization, passport or proof that you've been vaccinated. That's not true. There's no such thing. And then coming back into the country, that also is confusing. You have to have a PCR test, which I got in the country that I was visiting. And then I had proof that had to be translated, because, of course, we came out in Macedonian, wasn't it, even in English. So I get it translated and I get to the airport and she goes, "Do you have an attestation form?" I go, "No, what is that?" And what it is a form saying I, the passenger, attest that I actually did have a test and it came out negative, which seems pretty stupid if you have the negative test translated with you. But that's, they gave me that and I got that filled out. It's a mess right now. And a passport, one standardized form, would definitely ease the flow of people in and out of airports. As far as going into restaurants and all that, I don't think passports are a great idea. I think that you just assume that there's an increased risk going into those kinds of public places. Young people going into bars and nightclubs, especially during spring break, and is a huge problem for spreading the disease. And I don't think carrying a piece of paper will affect it one way or the other. And please, Ron DeSantis as a presidential candidate. Oh, my God. That's the most scary part that we've discussed all morning.
Yeah.
And Joe, you know, for folks that have been watching what's occurring in Europe, there's a huge spike in COVID cases. It's a fourth wave. And if you look at what's happened with COVID, Europe's been 2 to 3 weeks ahead of us in a lot of these issues. And that's what's really scaring me. And we're hearing it from CDC, you know, that the officials are really concerned that we're as a society pretending that everything is safe and we're moving ahead, and it's not. So we need to remain vigilant. And God, I just hope we don't open a little early and set us back for months and months.
Chris.
Yeah, I mean, Ron DeSantis, I mean, I think he is running for president. I think that's why he's so vocal on this. But it is a little bit of a strange position for somebody who from Florida to assume, given that, you know, this is one of the things that would be really useful for, say, the cruise ship industry, right? I mean, who's going to get on a cruise ship if you think there are people on there who, if you think it could be, you know, at the outbreak
I think you could have stopped at who's going to get on a cruise ship, but that's all right.
Yeah, well, with a bunch of unvaccinated people, especially.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, if private industry wants these sorts of
measures because they think it can get them open and get the economy going again. It's hard to object to it. I do think, you know, Rosemary raises an interesting point. There are certainly privacy concerns too, and like you said, Joe, accessibility concerns. But overall, I mean, the rhetoric is obviously conspiratorial and overheated and frankly pretty insane in some quarters.
Bob, we have to go to a break, but do you know the answer to this question? And I ask you, given your Homeland Security background, but what does, in something like, and I'm not directly saying the Excelsior Pass, but what makes that foolproof in the sense of keeping it from me giving it to somebody else, giving my phone to somebody else?
It doesn't, Joe, but it's a baby step in trying to ensure that people have a vaccine. If people want to circumvent, they're going to do it. You know, for the problem of people using fake IDs and fake licenses has been with us for a really long time. Nothing is foolproof.
It's how you get through college, right? Okay, we'll take a break. We'll be back. I mean, not us, of course, but, you know, I've heard about it. It's 59 minutes past the hour. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have letters and many more stories to discuss. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and we'll get news with Ray Graff first after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Before the break, we were talking about vaccine passports and the political football that has become or is becoming, probably more accurate to say. We got several letters on it, so let me go to those. We begin with Alvin, who says, I printed out an Excelsior Pass for my husband as soon as he had a second shot. It expires in a month, April 26. What good is this? We have to print out another one every month. I think it updates by itself, is my understanding, but I'm not positive on that. And I have heard that is just to sort of in the initial stages. I don't know. Bob, did you hear anything different about that?
I hadn't, Joe. I'm sorry.
Okay. That's all right. Sometimes you're so on top of that stuff. Neil said the idea is working well in Israel. They reopened theaters to those who have their vaccine. As someone who works in theater, it helps those who are out of work do it for others, like wearing a mask. Then that's the question of is it voluntary or not? And then if it's not, if it is voluntary, then how foolproof is it? Deborah says, can anyone explain the meaning of the expiration date on the New York passport? Again, a question about that. I was fully vaccinated in early March, and my expiration date is listed as March 26th, i.e. already expired. I think that it is a great idea, by the way. We'll work on trying to get an answer to that. Joseph writes, where are your papers is something I hear with a German accent circa 1940s. Do we really want to create a society that is segmented like this, where some are pariahs and others are overlords? A medical hierarchy that does not address the many health issues people have, including polymorphisms that may make people susceptible to the vaccine side effects. No to vaccine passports. Alan.
Well, you've heard what I have to say about this. I think, yes, there are imperfections about it. We certainly understand that. It's all been laid out. The people who have the least will be, punished. On the other hand, the more that we can assure that people can move around and that other people will be kept safe, even if it's imperfect, is a great idea, and I'm all for it.
All right, I have two letters. One starts with the words, I agree with Rosemary, and the second begins with the words, I disagree with Rosemary. So we'll go with
the second one first.
No, I was just going to say the opposite.
All right. Mary agrees with you. Besides access issues, there are legitimate concerns about people who can't get the vaccine, people who had convalescent plasma and can't get vaccinated for 90 days, etc. For people with those circumstances, HIPAA becomes an issue because they might have to disclose information about their health status to claim a waiver. to the I disagree with Rosemary letter from Bob. Patrons of restaurants and bars may be free to assume the heightened risk and choose to accept it, but what about staff who have to say, have no say in the matter? Vaccine passports are the best way I've heard to protect them from the unvaccinated. Rosemary.
I'm not sure how it protects them. You're not going to let people in if they don't have a passport. Yeah, I guess that would protect them when it was only letting vaccinated people. So good. Yeah. I mean, remember what I said. I hate the idea of papers, but the pandemic changes everything.
Chris,
it doesn't necessarily protect restaurant workers because you can still spread the virus if you're vaccinated. So there's a bit of a flaw in that argument, and which goes to something I was thinking about saying earlier, which is I do think that there may be this passport plan may give us kind of a false sense of security where we think, oh, everyone in here has the passport, therefore there's no risk to employees or other people
in there.
It isn't
false. There's a reduced risk, and there definitely is.
Yeah, there's a reduced risk, right,
according to the CDC. Right. I mean, yeah, you have to publicize it correctly. It's not like the only really safe way is to wrap yourself in saran wrap and stay in your house. But
yeah,
if you want to go to a restaurant, you're already taking a limited risk.
Bob?
Right, yeah. And so, I mean, and the way to eliminate that risk or reduce it for the staff is obviously to get them vaccinated. That is probably, in some ways, a more foolproof strategy than the passport plan.
Yeah, but there's, you know, all we are trying to do is buy down risk, and that's what
right.
That's what this whole debate about is, that how do we try to minimize? You cannot not there isn't any single step we're going to take that's going to get us to pre-COVID levels. So this is just, if you think about this as in combination with still having to wear a mask, still doing basic hygiene, you know, wash your hands, cough into your sleeve, be as socially distanced as you can. All of these steps are put in place in order to buy down risk, but nothing is going to be 100% effective. What it does though is it's another, you know, it's another step in trying to ensure that people can be safer than they would have been, at the same time allowing the economy to get back on its feet. The other thing before we get into all the vitriol is what's your other solution? You do nothing, and you know, like you just said, Rosemary, wrap yourself in plastic wrap and stay home. Or you just throw the doors open and you say that we're going to accept a higher level of death and incapacitation. I mean, unfortunately, there are really two bad extremes here, and there isn't a great answer.
So we have some interesting.
Well, Ron DeSantis took the one extreme, and now he's running for president. So I know which one of those I would pick. Jeez, crazy, crazy.
Fran makes an interesting point. I received my Moderna vaccines in Florida before Governor DeSantis realized that there were, you know, non-Floridians in his state. I tried to apply for the Empire Pass, and all questions start with received in New York, tested in New York, ... No provision for a vaccine administered elsewhere. What to do if a New York resident received their vaccine in the foreign state of Florida? Interesting point.
Yeah, and that's what the Biden administration is talking about getting involved in this, because there does need to be some sort of coordination between states and between, you know, agencies and et cetera.
I want to ask, can you get a shot if you're a resident of one state in another?
What do you mean?
If you're a New Yorker, you can't get a shot in Massachusetts. So this would affect a very small number of people, wouldn't it? Those who have like dual citizenship, dual residence in two states.
I think the answer is it depends.
Yeah,
on the various states and what their rules are.
You know, there are some states, and I know there are southern states that because of the COVID tourism were opening their doors and saying, we have the shot, so come from wherever you are and we'll give you a shot.
Serbia did that this week. The country of Serbia is inviting people in from other European countries to get their excess shots. It's very weird.
Yeah, it's a really interesting boy. Serbia is a very interesting model to look at for a country that is doing a lot of things right. The point that Chris made is really important, and it goes back to conversations we've had both with the Biden administration and the Trump administration, is that by its nature, a pandemic needs to be a federal issue, because coordination among and between the states is critical. It can only be done at the federal level. Now, to answer Rosemary's point, yes, you can get shots in other states because of the type of work that you do or where you work. So there are exceptions to the residency requirements in almost, I think, in almost every state. I haven't looked at every single state's rules, but I'm assuming that they're pretty similar.
Alice writes, aren't some of the people complaining about the passport ID the same people who want voters to present an ID before they're allowed to cast their vote?
Great letter.
Oh, my God. What a point.
Good one. Yes.
Yeah. Very good point. Kim writes, the CDC has established a reduced, by the way, this is the subject line to this particular email is Churchill misstates the case. So with that said.
Not for the first time, I'm sure.
No, I think the first time in this program, certainly, if it's true. The CDC has established a reduced risk of spreading the virus for vaccinated individuals, and they are beginning to see signs that that risk is close to zero.
Well, you know, when
that's
we
true,
show
that's great. If that's true, that's great news. That isn't, you know, I hadn't read that, but.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, Chris. When Walensky was crying on the air basically the other day,
yes,
and talking about doom, my sense of it was she knew more than we did, and that the variances are very problematic. What's happening here?
Well, and it makes sense, Chris, to your point, which I think is a good one. Even if let's say, I mean, there are vaccines that are being given, Johnson & Johnson, which what has, I think at best, a 70% rate. So that's, you know, that's 70 people out of 100. But what about the other 30, right?
Well, and, Joe, as has been pointed out to me so many times, it isn't that it's 70% effective. It's almost, as
yes.
people have kept telling me, 100% effective when it comes to death or serious disease.
Right. But as far as transmitting the disease, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that, right? There are going to be cases where people have been vaccinated and still get COVID, whether it is you know, a mild case or severe. Bob?
Yeah, and I think this is the problem with any vaccination is that, again, it's not going to be effective for 100% of the people because nothing is going to be. I despise the ads on TV about the different type of drugs, although I do listen with some interest to all of the side effects that they put out. And it's because we're all different. And The vaccines are intended to try to protect as many people as possible, but never claim to be able to protect 100%. I'll also note that I'm always interested that the side effects always seem to have to do with lower GI discomfort or flu-like symptoms, which always makes it difficult to figure out what the hell is going on.
Absolutely. Lee writes in
Pfizer is saying that its vaccine is 100% effective in young adults. That just came out today.
Which is really pretty exciting news.
The other complicating factor is we don't know how long the vaccines last, how long the immunity lasts once you've received it. So, I mean, that's another complicating factor for the idea of a passport.
Which may answer the aforementioned question about expiration.
The expiration date.
So, yeah. Alan?
Yeah.
You can always put dates on all of this stuff, but you're right, Chris. I mean, it's not perfect. The question is it better?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I understand your point, Chris. I think it was your point about a false sense of security of having the pass, but I have to say, you know,
I totally agree.
I think it's good.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, at least you have some proof that you've been vaccinated. Right. Lee says in the discussion of vaccine passports, you have admitted that the Excelsior passport can also be used to prove you have received a timely negative test result. That is absolutely true. The test result part may also explain the fast expiration dates. A few lines of code need to be updated to fix that. So that from Lee. Lynn said, My son Benjamin is off from school today, and he is listening. He wanted me to send this message saying, this is from a fourth grader, saying that he doesn't understand what the big deal is just to wear a mask, and he says, quote, I've been lucky enough to go to school since September, and we're all wearing masks, and nobody's complaining, and we're just kids. Grown-ups are worse than us and complain an awful lot. Just do it.
So, and the best letter we ever got.
Benjamin, welcome. Thank you so much for listening. You're spot on.
Last line is, just do it, and let's get Corona over with, because I'm sick of it, says Benjamin. So, yes, good letter.
Benjamin has a fan club.
Thank you, Benjamin. Thank you for listening. Thank you for writing. Jules.
I just lost my spot on the roundtable. Benjamin will be here next time.
I was just going to say, which one of us is replaced by Benjamin next time?
Benjamin's agent has already called us. Jules says, I have relatives in other states who believe a digital vaccine passport is part of a Chinese conspiracy. I do not know how to respond. I look for your guidance.
Say to them, go away.
And while you're at it, I keep hearing from young women who are afraid to have the shot because they might want to have children someday. That's my favorite one. I don't know what to respond. Well,
I'd be careful about that, Rosemary. They do. My wife was warned about that when she received the vaccine, so there might be some truth to that.
Yeah, I don't know. I understand. And I understand that concern whenever you're talking about pregnancy.
So it's a funny question. They asked the pregnancy question to everybody because they asked it to me when I was getting my shots, and they asked me if I was thinking about getting pregnant, and I said yes, but I've been unsuccessful so far, and they had no idea what to do with the answer. It put them in a very tough spot. I thought it was really funny. They didn't.
Yeah.
The idea of wanting to know what drugs you're putting in your body if you are pregnant is different, though, than saying if you get the shot, you won't be able to become pregnant. Those are two different things.
Absolutely. Yes. Good point. I don't know if we helped the listener as to what they say to their relatives who believe it's a Chinese hoax.
Well, I try to.
Yeah. Tell them to go away.
Get lost.
But they're relatives. How do you do that to your relatives?
Well, that changes everything.
Interestingly, the Chinese vaccine, about which we hear nothing here, is relatively effective, and it has fewer side effects than most of the other drugs. And in China and in Asia, it's widely being used for people who have difficulty, who are at risk for reactions. And the Russian one is apparently quite harsh, and it's and the reactions you can get to it. I find this really interesting that we're yelling about AstraZeneca, but we don't talk about the Chinese or Russian one. And
the Russian,
a worldwide cure to this will require all kinds of vaccines, I think.
The Russian vaccine story is fascinating because there is some question as to whether because you don't know what to believe, obviously. And because they're saying that it's great, it's a great vaccine, that they're exporting, but ultimately they're importing the vaccine. So that's an interesting story to me.
That's right. And the Chinese are hardly studies in veracity, I would think. We have a lot of trouble getting in. We can't see their lab. We don't really know what they're doing. And there's been a lot made of that.
Meanwhile, Russia is also...
Joe, back to the letter.
Yeah, go ahead.
Last piece of advice to the letter writer. It's true. You can't pick your family, but you can choose not to take their call.
That's a good point. I mean, I like to be respectful of their views, but, it's hard. They may not be invited to the get-together until this is all worked out. Also want to point out, I thought the other part of that Russia story... I went down a rabbit hole the other day reading a lot about Russia and the vaccine program. But Russia, I believe, is the first country to register for the a COVID vaccine for animals, which is fascinating. I didn't know it was that prevalent in animals, but apparently they have they're registering that as well for whatever it is worth. We'll go, meaning the story.
But, Joe, they have been giving vaccines to animals. I saw articles about the primates at the San Diego Zoo getting shots. So, I mean, that's something that is occurring here as well.
Cool. Let me remind you, with all due respect, says Peter, we are in a dire climate crisis, which is never broached on this program, really.
That's so untrue. That is so untrue.
Wow. All travel should be... I want Judith to defend us on that. All travel should be discouraged anyway, which would greatly reduce emissions and help enormously. Anyway, to make travel more difficult is good, sorry, but true. Okay, but we're not talking even about travel. We're talking about going to your local theater or art museum.
Well, how are you going to get there, Joe?
Yeah, I get. You know, you could look. People could, well, whatever.
And on the
Delta
front,
you're going to walk or ride your bike.
Yeah.
And on the Delta front, I just heard that Delta is going to fill that middle seat. I believe it's Delta. I may be wrong. It's going to fill that middle
seat. Oh, I think, yeah. They've been, I don't know about Delta, but I know some, like the airlines, from what I've heard. Rosemary, was your flight completely booked or was it?
I didn't have any crowded airline. I had seats behind me and in front of me the whole way over. And I understand the point. I my carbon footprint because of traveling is huge, but it is. I think Judith would say this: it is a misnomer to blame individual travelers. The root cause of massive pollution that's threatening the environment comes from fossil fuel and governments and industry, not from individual travelers.
Brad says a vaccine passport should be required document for healthcare workers, in particular nursing home staff. The idea that people working directly with elderly residents 24/7 without being required to be vaccinated is an affront to logic and to public safety, which is different than having a requirement for your business of where you work, I would think, right? And having you have to have it to go into, say, the grocery store. Not that that is being, just using that as an example. Bob?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that there are so many other groups that I'd put in the categorization, including teachers, EMTs, firefighters, police officers. I mean, the problem is when you start to think about who interacts with the public, everybody needs to have the vaccine if they're able to take it, which is why the rollout of this is so difficult. The other piece that I just want everybody to remember is that we're kind of making this up as we go. You start to think about a pandemic and how modern society deals with it. We've never done it before. So there are a lot of lessons that we do need to learn, but I don't want to claim that there's some great plan that lays out every step that we need to take.
And we have to go to a break, but in one of the weirdest political sound bites that I've heard in a very long time, and that's saying a lot given our current state of affairs, when Mitch McConnell on Monday said, "I can say as a Republican man, as it was my turn, I took the vaccine," I would encourage all Republican men to do that. What?
Well, I think what he's trying to do, I mean, there's a large vaccine hesitancy in that demographic. So I think he's just trying to,
Rosemary, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought it was a good move. And it's similar to Trump saying, it's probably a good idea to get the vaccine. That's where one of the largest walls of resistance has been shown to exist.
Yeah, Chris Christie's out there doing the same thing.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We have our last break together, so we'll make the most of it with our wonderful panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin. We do welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We just ask that you keep your letters short and to the point, and we'll try to get to as many as we possibly can on the other side of our news break. But first, we will have a brief message in the news from the BBC, WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin make up our panel, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. And let's move on to another topic or two before our time together ends this morning. I would like to talk about the Derek Chauvin trial because it continues, and each day is it is. I mean, it's what, I don't know about you all, but it's what we're watching, and it is very emotional and very compelling, and brings up a lot of issues, and it is something obviously that is being most watched, rightfully so. And so I would like to spend a moment or two on the second day of the trial. The teenager who filmed the viral video of Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck tearfully recalled Tuesday how the black man begged for his life and the cold look in the face of the white police officer accused of killing him. It was a deeply emotional testimony from Darnella Frazier, who was just 17 when she came across Floyd being restrained by the police. She testified on the lingering anxiety and guilt she feels about Floyd's death and not doing more to intervene. Frazier told the jury of looking at her father, her brother, her cousins and friends, and the anguish she felt knowing it could have been one of them, quote, on the ground and how it had added to her guilt. It's been nights I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George for not doing more. And not physically interacting and not saving his life, Frazier tearfully said. Frazier was one of several eyewitnesses called to the stand Tuesday, including four girls who were under the age of 18 when they saw Floyd being held to the ground by Chauvin and two other officers during a May 25th police investigation into an alleged counterfeit $20 bill. And just when you hear that, if that's what they were investigating, it just makes you shake your head, too. Alan, thoughts?
Well, I've been watching it. I can't take my eyes off of it. I have to tell you, if there ever is an argument about why we should have cameras in the courtroom, this is it. I think people can watch this. They can have an idea whether police will be held responsible for bad actions. Whether or not the law makes sense and the laws that governing all of this make sense, whether the procedures in a trial make sense, whether the judge's rulings are fair and good. I think this is an extraordinary learning experience for all of us. And it's also a time for understanding what justice in America may be or may not be.
Bob Griffin.
Joe, it's heartbreaking, I pray that there's some mental health counseling for particularly for the teenagers that witness the event, because the trauma that they're continuing to experience is obviously gut wrenching. Let me ask you and all the listeners this question, because I've been struggling with this all night. If I had been there, what would I have done?
Right.
Would I have jumped in and tried to physically get involved, even though it was an active police scene? Would I have the courage to do that?
What answer did you come up with?
I haven't come up with an answer, Alan. And this is really what I'm struggling with, because I was brought up with this respecting authority, respecting the police. Being supportive but not getting in the way, letting the experts do their job. All of those issues were running through my head. But then I'm looking on the other side, saying, as a moral human being, should I have just stood there? I'll take this case and also extrapolate it to the news coming out of New York about the anti-Asian hate, where people stood by and did nothing when 65-year-old woman was being beaten and kicked and
continue to go in and out of the store as if nothing was happening.
Nothing was happening, and I'm juxtaposing these two situations, it is really troubling. I would like to think that I would have the moral fortitude to do what the fire department the firefighter was trying to do. But I would hope that I could be more forceful. But this is what scares me now, is that I don't want to start to get into a situation where everybody who looks at a police scene thinks that they can physically get involved. So I'm really struggling. But my heart continues to bleed for the Floyd family, but also everybody who experienced that horrible, horrible scene.
And, you know, as a girl was testifying yesterday, the one thing that did cross my mind, and I agree with you, Bob, and all that you just said, but you do think to yourself, well, thank God the one thing that you did was you videoed it, because otherwise we wouldn't have what we have.
And call the police.
And call the police. That's right.
And a lot of them did that. You know, yeah. I think if you jumped in, you would have been in bad trouble. That's for sure with these rogue cops. Calling the police, I thought, was really showed an awful lot of guts and determination and was good.
Rosemary.
I'm not sure he was a rogue cop. I think his whole defense is built on this man followed his training and police control is ugly but necessary. He did exactly what he should have, which is terrifying to me. I don't get the defense at first until I figured out that's what they're really going after, which means we've got to change more than get rid of the rogue cops. We have to change training. Every time that defense attorney questions and does cross-examining, if I were on the jury, I'd be saying, oh, he's so guilty. He's so guilty. He just is combative. He's trying to make them seem like they were at fault, not his guy. Chauvin sits there taking notes, which, of course, is a well-known defense mechanism because the jurors are looking for his reaction, and he has to look interested but not show any emotion, so you scribble on a pad of paper. It's just so maddening. I'm having a really hard time giving him his presumption of innocence. I believe that the prosecution had it right at the very beginning. You can believe your eyes. This was a murder. Now, what I want to know is, why did the time change? Why is it, it used to be that we'd say 8 minutes and some seconds. Now we're up to 9 minutes. We're getting close to 10 minutes that that guy was on that poor man's neck. 10 minutes. Jeez.
Yeah. Awful. Yeah. And we are learning more in the trial. I mean, that is absolutely, absolutely true. Chris.
Well, I agree with everything that's been said. I mean, I think Rosemary's right that what will be on trial is the training that the officer received. I mean, that was a big factor in the Daniel Prude case in Rochester, and it's a factor in a lot of these cases. And the bald fact, and this doesn't excuse what Officer Chauvin did at all, but the bald fact is that training does need to change. Police do need to be less aggressive, especially with, you know, cases like Prude, who was mentally ill. There was just no excuse for the aggression that they responded with. And to go to what Bob said, my mind went to the exact same place. When I didn't watch the trial, but when I read the guilt that some of the witnesses felt, you know, all this time later, I immediately thought of the two people, at least in New York City, who didn't do anything at all to intervene to help that woman. I think she's in her 60s, the Asian woman who was attacked. Yeah, and there was an arrest 65. In that case today.
65, yeah.
Yeah, that just happened. Yeah, it wasn't a store where, at least the video that I saw, it was a camera inside a luxury apartment. They were essentially like doormen. And as she's kicked to the ground, stomped on it, and the aggressor walks off, they shut the door. Not only did they not help, they shut the door. It's just, there should be a charge against that.
Well, and there was one there where somebody was leaving and then just goes, sort of sees that there's a commotion and then just immediately turns to the left, which is bizarre as well.
It was horrible. And the idea that they didn't rush to her aid, apparently, either when, you know, after the attack was over. I mean, everything about it is just horrifying. And I hope that those people feel some sense of guilt today, too.
And how do you, and how do you investigate these cases too? And that's the other thing of how you investigate them and where you go from here. And I know a lot can be done, but man, it's, you wonder how many aren't reported, how many of this, you know, how much of this happens every day and nothing comes as, you know, we don't hear anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And please, I mean, please, I'm totally supportive of law enforcement, and I absolutely appreciate everything that they go through every single day and the risks that they face. At the same time, though, Joe, it goes back to conversations that we've had many times that we have to, I really feel strongly that we have to demilitarize the way police interact with citizenry, that we have to rethink what policing means and what care means and what a response should be. I've advocated in past on the show that, that mental health professionals need to be on the streets with the police to be able to assess situations to see if they can be de-escalated rather than escalated the way we saw in the Floyd case. But most importantly, Joe, I think we as a society need to demand a higher level of morals from people who want to have a badge and enforce the laws. And I think the screening needs to be better. And I also think the pay needs to be better.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris?
To go to Bob's point, I mean, Tish James, Attorney General Tish James, did a long investigation, very thorough investigation of the Daniel Prude case. And that was one of the things she highlighted, was that police spend a lot of time being trained in how to subdue people, and they spend almost no time whatsoever on de-escalation and how to calm people. It's very militaristic style training, and I think I don't know that that's, you can be blame that fully on what happened in Minneapolis, but I do think that that's a big factor in a lot of these cases. You know, the de-escalation needs to be a much, much more significant part of what police are trained to do.
Yeah.
Joe, I taught at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and I had a lot of cops in my classes. It's interesting because you taught the same class in the morning and at night so that the cops could go either time depending on what their shift was.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was a certain decision that was made, which was the kids are going to come in the day and the cops are going to come at night. So you saw a huge differential in what people said when you were talking to them about what was going on in your teaching and the rest. I'm just simply saying there is something other than the training in what attracts people to police work. There are many good policemen, that's for sure. But there is a sort of culture that goes on, and that is why we really have to, in addition to talking about the training, which has to happen, obviously, you got to really talk about what attracts people to what the psychology of policing is.
What makes you want to do that? Yeah.
And isn't there a chicken or the egg factor with that, Alan? I mean, is it what people are trained once they get into police work, or is it a mentality of a certain person who? I mean, how does that culture develop, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
I'm not sure
that a lot of it doesn't have to do with the training that they receive.
Well, certainly you can't discount it. However, my observation is certain types of people get attracted to police work. And you can't say it's everybody, because it's not. There's some wonderful policemen and who are very decent, and we have many of them. I hate to give a plug here in Great Barrington, but we do. But then there are some police forces which attract like-minded individuals, and so it's not one or the other, but I would stick with what I'm saying, that some people are attracted to police work.
You have to have the right personality. There's no doubt about it. Even in fire and rescue, which is the area that I initially came from, you have to, I always make the joke that, I have to have a screw loose because I liked running into burning buildings. Logically said, you run away. So there, you're right, Alan. There's definitely a personality. I'll also note that, we're seeing a preponderance of folks from the military being given preferential hiring into police forces. So it's actually harder to create a balance, I believe, in the culture of police forces, because, there are so many folks who are already coming in with training from the military, which is fundamentally different in my mind from police training. Again, it's not a condemnation of the military or the police. The other thing that
we're out of time, Bob. I'm sorry.
All right, no worries.
No, that's what we're just up against it, and we have to go. But I want to thank everybody. We lost Rosemary somewhere along the way, so sorry about that. I don't know what happened, but we'll try again, I guess. Alan, thank thank you very much. And Chris and Bob, thank you. Sorry I had to cut you off, Bob. And we'll have the Congressional Corner next on WAMC.